2002 was a year of war in Afghanistan, of potential war in Iraq, and of terrorism. It did not see what many feared, another major attack in the United States. The economy in 2002 was battered by waves of corporate scandals, a shaky stock market, and layoffs, and it wavered between recession and a soft spot. Republicans took control of both houses of Congress. Cardinal Bernard Law resigned amidst the scandal over sexual abuse and cover-up in the Catholic Church, and in October, residents in the Washington, D.C. area were terrified by a three-week murder spree. Before it was over, two alleged snipers killed 10 people and injured three more. 2002 also saw the rescue of nine miners trapped underground for 3 days in Pennsylvania, unlikely triumphs for the New England Patriots and the Anaheim Angels, and the weird and wonderful moments at the Winter Olympic Games. Today, we revisit some of the topics we discovered and this past year and a few of the people we talked to. How have their lives changed? What's happened since we last checked in? Over the course of this hour, we'll speak with a Palestinian man who was holed up in his apartment during the Israeli siege of the West Bank, and with an Israeli woman whose small travel business is in trouble. We'll find out where the sniper investigation stands today, what's happening to the corporate CEOs, some of whom we saw being led away in handcuffs, and we want to hear from you. What stories do you want to hear follow-ups on? Which of our guests would you like to hear from again? Our telephone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we'll begin with the repercussions of an event that happened in 2001, the destruction by the Taliban of two giant statues of Buddha carved some 1,800 years ago into the cliffs of central Afghanistan. Almost since the ouster of the Taliban, plans have emerged to rebuild the Buddhas and preserve other artifacts in the same area. Last month, UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, organized a meeting in Munich to discuss the future of the Buddhas. Joining us now on the phone to tell us what came out of that meeting is Christian Manhart. He's Asia Program Specialist for UNESCO. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So what condition are the statues in right now? Are they totally destroyed?
Yes, not only the two large statues are destroyed, but also the five small statues around. And they are really in very bad shape. They have fallen down from the walls of the niches, and we have to take a decision what to do with the pieces which have fallen down.
So what came out of this UNESCO meeting?
During this meeting, we invited all the specialists who have worked previously on Bamiyan or who would like to be involved in Bamiyan projects, and we tackled several problematics. For example, the mural paintings, because the Buddhist caves in the Bamiyan cliffs, there are 700 of them. Some of them have mural paintings of 4th to 7th century. Then we also tackled the problem of the cliffs, which have dramatically suffered under the dynamiting by the Taliban when they blew up the statues. We also discussed what to do with the pieces which have fallen down from the Buddhas, and we discussed archaeological explorations, because there are still many things under the ground which have not yet been discovered in Bamiyan.
So preservation of that which still exists, such as the murals you were talking about, that's more of a priority at this point than rebuilding the Buddhas. Why is that?
Yes, so the mural paintings, unfortunately, they have a lot suffered, and we have today only 20% of what they were in the 1970s. We invited to Munich the two Japanese professors, Professor Miyagi and Professor Maeda, who have carried out the inventory of these mural paintings. They published four volumes in Japanese in the 1970s, and they have carried out a mission with us in last October to see what is left, and they were very much shocked when they saw that most of the mural paintings have been destroyed by neglect, but also many of them have been stolen, and the 20% which still are in the caves have been blackened by the Taliban, who burned tires in the caves in order to blacken them. And this was even not enough. They took shoes, put them in white color, and humiliated those Buddhist mural paintings even much more by stepping with the shoes on them. Mm-hmm. And our aim is now to conserve what is still left, so these 20%. As far as the pieces of the Buddhas are concerned, it is not a priority to reconstruct the Buddhas because we think we do not have enough pieces to reconstruct them with the original remains. And some Afghans, but also some other institutions, work very hard in favor of complete reconstruction with new materials such as concrete or some even in resin or in brick. And it was agreed upon with the Afghan government and with the specialists that such a reconstruction could not be a priority, so that the priority is the consolidation of what is left now in Bamyan.
Even if you had all the money you needed and everything else was done, are there reasons not to reconstruct these Buddhas?
Yes, there are two main reasons. The first one is the Venice Charter, which is an internationally agreed charter on authenticity of cultural property, which means that cultural property which has completely been destroyed cannot be reconstructed. It can only be only a part of a total cultural property can be reconstructed if this part helps to consolidate the still existing pieces. And the second reason would be more a religious one, because today in a Muslim country it is by religion forbidden to construct statues, and therefore we want to give much more time to the Afghan people and to the Afghan government to take a decision on this. But the final decision on the reconstruction will be taken by the Afghans, because no other institution such as UNESCO or the International Council on Monuments and Sites or other governments can take this decision and can be involved in the decision-making process of the Afghan people and the Afghan government.
We want your questions, not just about what stories or people you want us to follow up on, things that you heard over the past year, but any questions you may have about the subjects we are discussing on today's program. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, the email address totn@npr.org. And Dev joins us on the line from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hello.
Hello.
Got two questions for your guest here. One is, from all the archaeological studies, who do you think originally built those Buddhas and the murals on the walls? And, I mean, wasn't that part of the whole Indian culture when it was built, like 1,800 years ago, as he says?
Christian Manhart?
Yes. So the builders of the Buddha statues and of the mural paintings and the caves were Buddhist, and they were constructed in a period between 4th century and 7th century. And the Buddhist culture came into this region from northern India, as you stated rightly, and also from China, as Bamyan was on one of the Silk Roads. So there was a lot of exchange of different cultures, but also Greek culture came in the 3rd century BC already in this region, and the style of Bamyan is the typical Greco-Buddhist style, and this makes these statues and also the mural paintings very unique.
And you had one other question, Dev?
Yes, and I'm wondering if you're going to involve any of the people from the archaeology department in India in your studies or reconstruction.
Yes, this is a very good question, because the Archaeological Survey of India has worked in Bamyan already in the past. They worked during 6 years in the 1970s, and I think it's thanks to them that the cliffs are still standing now, because they constructed a retaining wall for them so that the cliffs did not collapse, and they also constructed on top of the cliffs a water drainage system which keeps the water away, because the water is like the human beings in Afghanistan, an enemy of these monuments, because in the winter the water penetrates, then it freezes up to minus 20 degrees Celsius and expands, of course, and then it makes the cliffs crack. And we invited already several times a representative of the Archaeological Survey of India to our missions and also to our meeting. Unfortunately, to the Munich meeting, nobody of the ASI came, but we are obliged to work with the people of the ASI in India.
Well, actually, my question was more the political. You talked about a lot of technical things, but basically, it is my understanding that Pakistan is asking U.S. to keep India out of Afghanistan, even though India has had a very good relation with Afghanistan in the past. Do you think that's going to be a problem?
No, absolutely not. Because, as you said, we are dealing with technical problems, and we hope that politics does not intervene too much. And during the meeting on the rehabilitation of Afghanistan's cultural heritage in May, which UNESCO organized in May 2002 in Kabul, where we had 107 specialists. We had representatives from India and from Pakistan, and they intervened during the same session, and they were sitting next to one another on the podium, and then they asked us to take a photograph of them, and they shook hands, and I think the specialists from India and Pakistan can work together.
Yes, I hope that it's more than those token photographs you're talking about.
Well, we can all live in hope for a new year, can't we, Dev?
Yeah, we hope so.
Okay, thanks very much. And Christian Manhart, thanks very much for you to joining us.
You're most welcome.
Christian Manhart is Asia Program Specialist for UNESCO, and he was with us on the phone from Munich, Germany. Half a world away from Afghanistan, terrorism struck the Indonesian island of Bali last October. A huge car bomb exploded near one of the island's popular nightclubs. Over 180 people were killed, most of them Australian tourists. Indonesian police are still investigating to find out those responsible for the blast. At the time, we spoke with Don George from Lonely Planet Publications to tell us about Bali as a tourist attraction. Don George is with us again to tell us how Bali is coping in the aftermath of the bombing. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. It's great to be back.
It's 2.5 months since the explosion. How is the economy there faring?
Well, I have a very mixed picture of Bali to present. Unquestionably, the economy has been deeply affected by the bombings and their aftermath, particularly in southern Bali. Hotel occupancy, which was probably about 75% to 85% before the bombings, is down to 15% to 20% now.
Ouch.
So that's a big ouch for the economy, and it has, as you know, ripple effects for the small street vendors and the restaurants and all the people who are attached in one way or another to the tourist economy. It affects all of them.
Now, you've not been back to Bali yourself, but you've talked with people who have been there. What are they telling you about the island?
Well, the island is as beautiful as ever, mm-hmm. As welcoming as ever. People are so happy to see the tourists who are coming, and there is a sense of incredible gratitude and connection with the world when people do come. Most of the people who are there now as visitors are repeat visitors. The first-time arrivals have dropped off very significantly, but a number of people have come back almost purely as a show of solidarity with the people of Bali. So that's been a very important part of the healing process for the Balinese people.
As you know, Don, a lot of tourist booking is done well in advance. Any indication that Bali's problems are going to be ameliorated in the near future?
There's cautious optimism. More flights are being reinstated in the new year. Especially from Australia to Bali, which is very important since the Australians are such a big part of the Balinese tourist scene. And also from the United States, there's more flights starting up. So there is renewed interest, and a locally owned, that is a Balinese-owned airline, is also starting in the new year. So that's a very good sign.
Don George, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Don George, global travel editor for Lonely Planet Publications, speaking to us on the phone from Oakland, California. More after a break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're catching up with some of the interesting people with whom we spoke in 2002 and catching up on some of the biggest stories of the year. In a few minutes, the corporate scandals and how many executives are headed up the river, and now the sniper. You're invited to join the discussion, of course. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Back in October, residents of Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia were terrorized by seemingly random sniper shootings that took place at shopping malls, gas stations, even at a local school. 10 people were killed, 3 injured during the 3-week shooting spree. 2 suspects eventually were arrested, John Lee Malvo, age 17, and 41-year-old John Allen Muhammad. Joining us now on the phone from Fairfax, Virginia, is Josh White. He's a Washington Post Metro reporter who's been covering the sniper investigation from the beginning, and good to have you on the program.
Thank you, Neil. Good afternoon.
There was a hearing this morning in Fairfax County for teenager John Lee Malvo. Can you tell us what happened there?
Sure. From what I understand, one of my colleagues, Maria Glaude, was in the hearing this afternoon, and it was basically a motion to get some information for the defense counsel in the case. And from what I understand, they were successful in essentially getting the police, the statements that John Malvo made to police regarding the shootings in Prince William County, Virginia, and Fairfax County, Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Now, overall, how many times have Malvo and Muhammad been charged so far?
Well, they've been charged, and they will be facing court hearings and trials in Prince William County, Virginia, and Fairfax County, Virginia. John Muhammad has been charged with capital murder and a few other charges in Prince William County, where he is scheduled to go to trial in October, about 1 year from the string of shootings in the Washington area. And Malvo is going through juvenile proceedings in Fairfax County, and it's unclear when exactly he's going to be in court, though it's probably going to be sometime.
And there are other charges pending in other jurisdictions, including Montgomery County, Maryland. Those will have to wait to see what happens in Virginia?
Yes, and there are charges throughout Virginia, in Hanover County, where there was a shooting in Ashland, Virginia, charges in Spotsylvania County, where there were 2 shootings there. And we're also waiting to see if there are going to be charges in other states as well. Montgomery, Alabama, where there was a shooting, and some shootings that they're investigating in Louisiana and in Washington State.
Mm-hmm. As you point out, other crimes have been linked to these, too. If every crime is prosecuted, it's going to be some time before they're all resolved.
It certainly will be some time. In any case, John Muhammad's trial scheduled to start in October. They've set aside 8 weeks for that trial, though both sides don't think it'll take that long. Even after that case is over, if these cases were to line up sequentially and to go on, it would probably be a matter of years before this is all over.
Now, there were 3 survivors, as we mentioned, including a 13-year-old boy who was shot outside of his school. What do we know about them today?
Well, at this point, we know that the 13-year-old boy has been out in public, has made appearances, actually was out with the First Lady talking about his experience and meeting with children at the hospital where he recovered. The 2 other victims in the Washington area who survived, one in Spotsylvania County and the one in Ashland, who is actually a gentleman from Florida, we know that they're out of the hospital and that they're doing okay. We're not entirely sure of what their situations are to this moment. But mm-hmm. from what we understand, they have survived and are sort of getting back into their routines.
After we've all had a chance to catch our breath, after all of the recriminations about who was cooperating with whom and who was leaking what and all of that sort of stuff has finally gone by the board, have you had a chance to sit down and think for a moment, you know, what did we learn about ourselves in all of this crisis?
Well, it was very interesting, especially for me living in the Washington area and living through this myself and watching us as reporters going out and dealing with it on a daily basis. I think we all sort of put the immediate issues aside while we're working on it. Looking back on it, it was certainly both a terrifying time for a lot of people and a very interesting time because we had never seen anything like it.
Hmm.
The community was affected on every level. I'll tell you, pumping gas took on a new meaning.
Our next caller is Roger, who's with us from Matthews, Virginia. Hello, Roger, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Okay.
My question is, what do you think, How long do you expect it, or do they expect it to take to get a verdict or a sentencing for the Malvo case, so they can see, you know, what type of justice will be served?
Josh?
Sure. In the Malvo case, it's unclear exactly how quickly things are going to move about. At this point, he's been charged as a juvenile and is going through the juvenile justice system in Fairfax County. At this point, there's been no trial date set. Likely what will happen in his case is they will they first have to certify him as an adult, would then move him up into adult court, and then things would proceed. As far as Mr. Muhammad goes, his trial at this point is scheduled to go ahead in October. Defense counsel and prosecutors believe that they will have a case at that point. And if the case does take 8 weeks, as they've said, we very well could have a verdict, at least in the Prince William shooting, by the end of 2003, early 2004.
But it seems like the evidence, there is evidence of a guilty conviction.
Well, certainly that's going to be up to a jury to decide. I think that prosecutors in both Fairfax County and Prince William County believe that they have a case in each jurisdiction against each of the suspects.
I got you. Let me give a shout-out to the Frame Shop and Gallery in Newport News. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Okay.
All right, man.
Roger, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, and an email question on the sniper case, this from Phil Loring in Fort Lauderdale. Josh, could you speak as to why John Malvo, who was a minor, did not have his identity protected?
Well, from all official standpoints, his identity was protected from the very beginning in the court system. It was well known at the time of the arrest and from then on to the media and to various other organizations that he was the one that they've been looking at. In Prince William County in particular, his name was not officially released as far as charges that might be placed against him there, but at the time and even in press conferences, people were essentially assuming that everybody knew who that was. I think when they first were trying to find them, the identity was out. People were looking for him and Mr. Muhammad, and I think it sort of logically followed from there.
Do you think that we're going to come away with any lessons learned from all of this?
Well, it's hard to say. Certainly, we're still learning a lot about the case as time goes on. We've been learning more and more every day. While it was occurring and since the arrest and since the investigation has been moving along, I think certainly at trial, when some of this evidence is presented publicly, we will have an idea of what exactly was going on, and we hope to learn what, if any, motive there was behind it.
Josh White, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Josh White is a Metro reporter for The Washington Post, and he spoke to us from the newspaper's offices in Fairfax, Virginia. Many companies were battered by financial scandal this year, including Enron, WorldCom, Tyco, Adelphia, and ImClone, which caught the doyen of domesticity, Martha Stewart, in its insider trading web. With us now from his office in Manhattan to update us on corporate scandal is Andrew Ross Sorkin, a business reporter for The New York Times. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good.
So, obviously going to take us a while, but where do the investigations stand right now, and why don't we begin with Enron?
Well, you know, most of these investigations were really in the midst. Some have gone all over the place, really. If you look at where Enron is now, the only fellow who's been indicted so far was Andy Fastow, who had been the CFO and then also the CEO for a short period after Ken Lay.
Chief Financial Officer and Commanding Officer, CEO?
He had been the CEO temporarily after Ken Lay had stepped down.
Oh, right, Chief Executive
Officer.
But
he's the only guy who's been put in handcuffs so far.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about it, the other guys, whether it be Jeffrey Skilling or Ken Lay, they're out. They're out and about, and so far there's been no problem there. If you look at Tyco, for example, Dennis Kozlowski, who was the CEO of that company, and its CFO, Mark Schwartz, have both been indicted. Their trials, I think, don't start until June. So I was just talking to Dennis's lawyer about 10 minutes ago. He's skiing in Colorado at the moment. Over at WorldCom, Scott Sullivan, who was their CFO and has been indicted for stealing, or not stealing, rather, but misrepresenting about $3 billion. He is, again, waiting trial. He's down in Florida building what is a 15,000-square-foot mega mansion, and that continues. So, you know, for some of these folks, they'd probably tell you their life has changed significantly, but you know, it's not always so clear.
So far, we know that Martha Stewart has not been charged with anything, yet her life has changed too, hasn't it?
You know, I mean, the question is really how much have their lives changed? Martha, all of these people would argue their lives have changed substantially. They don't go to work every day. They have to spend half their days with lawyers, and, they probably can't, a lot of them can't go out. Scott Sullivan of Enron was having some problems at a restaurant a couple of weeks ago where this woman threw wine at him at the table because she was so disgusted with him. So these people's lives have changed. But in terms of, they're not in prison and they're not, it's not that different. It depends. I mean, I'm sure you can argue it both ways.
If you've got questions about the corporate scandal or stories we covered this past year or people you'd like to hear from again, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. And we have a question from Mark in Anchorage, Alaska.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is, how can anybody take Bush's, corporate cleanup talk seriously when Thomas White is Secretary of the Army? Now, this is a guy who's last, 9 or 10 years, was Vice President of the Enron Energy Trading Unit.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't covered, they talk about Enron in terms of these tricky financial deals, but there was a lot of stuff that was much easier to see, like what they referred to as the third floor build-out, where they constructed a stage set to fool stock analysts into energy trading was just people acting. I mean, he knew about this stuff, and here he is as Secretary of the Army, and we're supposed to trust the lives of our fellow Americans to his guidance. And
Mark, a word we have to use in the radio business is allegedly involved in all this, or allegedly knew about it. But Andrew Sorkin.
Okay. Yeah.
Andrew Sorkin, what's going on? At one point, there was a lot of pressure on Mr. White to resign as Secretary of the Army.
There was a lot of pressure on him. There's been a lot of pressure on a lot of folks throughout this entire process who've been in government or related to this. Dick Cheney had some problems when there was some accusations that he knew what was going on at Halliburton. Obviously, some of those problems have been exposed this year. It's really unclear what happens to the politicians. But what I think can be said is that there has been obviously reform in Washington, and hopefully that reform is trickling down to the corporations. I don't think we've been able to see substantial changes yet in corporate governance practices, or at least the results of them. But I think over the next year or two, we'll be able to gauge whether all of these lessons have worked or not.
Are the reforms being taken seriously? I mean, are companies saying, boy, this really does change the way we operate?
I think the boards are operating at a very different level. And as over the next year, you're going to see the audit committees of certain boards and compensation committees of certain boards that had previously been inhabited by insiders run really by outsiders. And the question is, will that make a substantial difference or not? But I do think there have been some changes, and there have been accounting changes. I think people are accounting for things less aggressively than they had. But at the same time, the end result of that is that, earnings for the next 2 or 3 years are not going to be as good as people had thought, because, if the earnings had been inflated over the past couple of years, and now they're accounting for all of these things at a different level, the positive growth and the stock price increases that we've seen for so long, it's not so clear they can come back so quickly.
Mark, thanks very much for the call.
Well, yeah, I would rather have the truth than a happy lie any day.
Okay, thanks very much. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Andrew Ross Sorkin is a business reporter for The New York Times. He's on the line with us from his office in Manhattan. And let's get another caller. Ruth is on the line from Indianapolis.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just kind of had a comment and a question. A lot of the talk is going towards the CEO and upper management of the Enron situation about the comment on building the homes. I'm wondering if there's any help or severances going out for the general workers of Enron, the families that lost everything, whether or not they had Christmas, if, in fact, the government or any private agencies are helping out those people while the CEOs are having, it sounds like, a great time building their new homes.
Right. Well, from what I know, there's 2 points. The fellow I was talking about earlier who was building the home is Mark. Is Scott Sullivan from mm-hmm. WorldCom and not Enron. But for the Enron employees, some of them received, I think most of them received some form of severance. And listen, this is obviously a bad situation for everyone, but I don't believe that there was any additional assistance. There was some groups, I think, locally in Houston that had come together to try to raise some money for certain families. But, you know, I hate to say this, and this may sound horrible. Most of the people at Enron were very highly paid workers. These were not industrial workers getting, $20,000 or $25,000 a year working at minimum wage. These were six-figure salary people, not across the board, but many of them. So hopefully they're not all living in poverty at the moment.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Thanks for calling, Ruth. Earlier this month, there was a 10 of the biggest brokerage firms in the country agreed to pay $1.4 billion to end an investigation into suspect research and stock recommendations that allegedly misled investors. What's going on with that? And is that to end that element of the scandal that people were misled by their brokers?
Well, you know, the scandal was that brokers were using analyst research, which was tainted because these big investment banks get most of their revenue really from doing work for the companies that the analysts are supposed to be analyzing. And so the new rules that have been put into effect are there hopefully to prevent analysts from trying to make good calls or suggest that stocks are going to go up for companies that the bank's also making money off of separately. It's going to be a long, long while before we find out if this is really going to work. What's going to happen is customers of brokers are going to be getting not only the research of that house. Say, if you were a broker of Salomon Smith Barney, you would get an analyst report for a certain company, but you would also get independent research, which they will buy from independent research houses, which are going to be probably springing up all over New York and probably parts of California in the next couple of months and years. And we'll see whether that works or not. It's questionable, and I think there's a lot of people who have a lot of questions about whether what happened is really going to be helpful or hurtful in the end.
Quickly, through the miracle of Chapter 11 bankruptcy, Enron is still in business, though under a new name?
Enron is still in business. WorldCom, also in bankruptcy proceedings, still in business under the same name. Tyco, still in business and doing okay so far, not in bankruptcy, by the way. Adelphia, which we haven't mentioned, also in business but under bankruptcy protection. So we'll have to see if these guys get out of bankruptcy or what happens next.
One more, ImClone?
ImClone, still in business.
Still in business?
Still in business.
And we keep reading all these stories.
But there's a lot, they're having a lot of problems. All of these companies are having a lot of problems.
We wouldn't be talking about them if they weren't. But we kept reading all these stories about their attempts to auction off that big crooked E from in front of the building in Houston. Did it ever sell?
I think it did sell. I don't remember how much, but I think it was $5,000 or $10,000 for that E, but I got to go back and look.
Bargain at the price. Andrew Ross Sorkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Ross Sorkin is a business reporter for the New York Times, and he was with us on the line from his office in Manhattan. We're looking back at some of the news events of the year. We're taking your calls, 800-989-8255. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR stations, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The Pew Charitable Trusts, investing in ideas, returning results, www.pewtrusts.com. The William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In an arched portico off Mexico City's Central Plaza sits street musician Carlos Garcia. It's an odd place for a player who's featured on a best-selling classical album. What's he doing there, and what's he playing? Find out later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, we'll end this year with some of the great moments in television history. Get ready with your favorites. Lucy's Baby, Rhoda's Wedding, 6 Feet Under, Bucky Dent's Homer, the first night of the Gulf War, or maybe the Checkers speech. Unforgettable moments of television tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're revisiting some of the topics we covered this past year and some of the people we met. You can join our conversation by giving us a phone call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Back in April, during the height of Palestinian suicide bombings and the Israeli siege of Palestinian areas, we spent one memorable hour speaking with regular people on both sides of the conflict. You may remember our conversation with Tali Tapperberg, an Israeli who owns a small travel agency in Jerusalem. This is what she told us then.
Since a year and a half, since the Intifada started, business are slowing down all over Israel. I'm selling tickets for Israelis to go out of the country. So this was not hurt as much as, you know, tourism inside Israel, because this is like just dead completely. Mm-hmm. No tourists come. I had to cut my staff into half. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, as a travel agency, you know, after September 11, we had another, shock.
Joining us now from her home in Jerusalem is Tali Tapperberg, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hello?
Hello, yes, good to have you.
Good to have you, Neil. Happy New Year.
And Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
That clip of tape we just played was from 8 months ago. How's your business doing today?
Well, I'm surviving, but I'm surviving. This is not business, you know. Business has to boom, not to survive. And, luckily, as I recall, I mean, we are just selling tickets for more and more people, unfortunately, to leave the country. But business around us are really slowing down. So I can say that our business went down this year in 10%. Comparing from last year, and expectations for next year is to go down 13% more.
I understand your husband's business is not doing too well either.
No, he's really doing very, very bad, because my husband is importing fashion from Italy, from Greece, mainly women's underwear, and since his best client is the biggest department store in Israel, they went bankrupt. So unfortunately, they owe him 2 million shekel, which is about $200,000. And this almost killed him.
Hmm.
Yeah, because the biggest department store, which is called the Masbil in Israel, had to close down.
Now,
a lot of businesses, especially, you know, private, are collapsing, unfortunately.
The other big issue, of course, besides the business, was your security, not only for you, but, of course, your husband and your children as well. Has the atmosphere changed? We're seeing fewer bombings.
Much, much better. Much better. I mean, I would say that terror has not disappeared, unfortunately. But since the Israeli invasion to all the Palestinian cities, and since soldiers are all the time, you know, watching. And since our mentality changed, because every big shop, every coffee shop, every office, big offices, banks, the post office, has a guard. I mean, you cannot have a little coffee shop without somebody open your purse.
Hmm.
So because, security become like 10 million times more. So thanks God, I mean, it looks like terror is a little bit down.
Yeah. When we spoke with you in April, you said you wouldn't let your kids, you have a girl 17, a boy 13, you wouldn't let them go on a bus anymore. Is that still the case?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I mean, as you know, a girl of 17, teenager, you know, you can't really control her 100%, unfortunately. But, they proved, even though, I mean, still buses are a hot target. I mean, more than 20% of the suicide bombers happen to be on buses. So, yeah, I mean, maybe, I mean, it's ridiculous because, I mean, you cannot know. I mean, this is like a guess, you know? You cannot know where is going to be to happen the next terror attack. But this is just like, you know, I feel as if I'm doing something because, I mean, you can't do anything against terror attack. But as if you tell yourself, I pay for a cab, which is much more, but I save my kids. You know, I think it's more psychological for me, maybe.
Dolly Topperberg, we know this is not Jewish New Year, but it is ours, so we can wish you Happy New Year.
I wish. Thank you.
Thanks very much for speaking with us again today.
Sure, thank you.
I know it's late, very late in the evening there in Jerusalem. With us now is another person we spoke with during that same program in April. Saeed Siffi is a Palestinian Muslim who was holed up in his apartment in Ramallah in the West Bank when we spoke with him last April.
This is my 11th day under the strict curfew, and actually I have to consume very little of the food that I have in my apartment, and knowing that this is my sixth day also with no electricity and with little of water. I mean, they were bombing the electric lines, and, you know, I don't know anything about the outside world. I just, like, call one of my friends in East Jerusalem every night just to ask him about what's going on in the world. So, I mean, it's a very miserable, bad situation here.
With us now on the phone from his office in Ramallah is Saeed Siffi, and good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Conan. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to you.
Thank you very much. Now, you were describing a pretty desperate situation back there in April. What's it like now in Ramallah?
Yes. Actually, I can say that it's not as bad as it used to be back when you called me last April.
Mm-hmm.
Still so far away from normal life, actually. You know, I can say that all the West Bank is occupied, all the cities are under, you know, curfew. Mm-hmm. Right now, Ramallah, where the city I live, is not under strict curfew. We can move around, but still, it's under full siege. We cannot exit from one city to another city unless we have a permit, which is almost impossible to get from Israeli military forces. So it's still a bad situation, but it's not as bad as it used to be last April.
Are there still food shortages?
No, actually, the situation regarding this thing is good. But as I told you, it's sometimes hard to get inside the cities. It's not sometimes, actually. Most of the time, it's hard to get inside the cities. So if you are living in rural areas, a village somewhere near the city, it will be very bad to get maybe your essential supplies sometimes.
Hmm. In a state of siege like that, we were just speaking with Tali Topperberg, an Israeli, talking about the increase in security where she lives. It must be an order of magnitude greater where you live.
Yeah, it's much, much greater. I mean, the whole cities are, as I told you, under full occupation from the Israeli forces. And I can tell you that the cities here almost live in chaos because there is no law enforcement units. Israeli troops, which take control over the ground here, care only about, you know, assassinating the resistant activists, which, you know, in a way endangers the life of civilian people here. And you can say that there is no law at all inside the cities, and it is a very tough situation. So in a way, we are subjected to, you know, various forms of repression, harassment, collective punishment. I can tell you that, you know, just 1 week ago, they decided to run buses, to allow buses to run from between cities in the West Bank. And unfortunately, a bus that started the journey from Ramallah to Nablus, which normally takes 30 minutes, took it more than 5 hours because of the checkpoints. So they stopped that journeys. So in a way, it's a very tough.
When last we spoke, you were working as a software engineer for an American company, Timex.
Yes.
We've reached you in your office, and we know you've got a new job. What are you doing?
Yes, I'm a web developer, still almost the same field in Palnet, which is, you know, an internet supplier here in the West Bank.
Palnet, it's called?
Yeah, it is called Palnet.
Well, good luck with it, and thanks very much for speaking with us again, and we wish you a very happy new year.
Thank you to you too, Conan. Thank you very much.
Saeed Saifi was speaking with us from Ramallah and also very late there, so we appreciate his taking the time to speak with us. You're listening with Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Finally this hour, under the rubric of Why People Do Crazy Things, earlier this year we spoke with a man who was attempting to swim the entire length of the Columbia River, a total of 1,243 miles. Christopher Swain was about to dive into the glacial headwaters of the Columbia River and begin his six-month swim downstream when we spoke to him last June.
In some sense, I'm trying to sort out why I felt called to swim the Columbia. I'm curious to see what I'll find and where that'll lead me on a personal level, and I'm certainly challenged to balance being a dad and being a husband and during the process. But I think most of all on the personal level, I see an opportunity here to both answer a call, but to try to do the right thing. I believe that if I get into that river, I can put the river in the public eye.
Well, joining us now from a boat in the middle of the Columbia River is Christopher Swain. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, Neil. How's it going?
Pretty good. So where exactly are you?
I'm in the middle of the river in a snowstorm south of Gifford, Washington, a little north of Hunters, maybe 69 miles from Grand Coulee Dam.
So how many miles does that make it that you've swum so far?
575 about. So I'm almost to the halfway point. And today the water's 41 degrees. And even in a wetsuit, I'm shivering after 2 minutes stopping to drink tea. And I was telling your producer a minute ago, I actually poured hot Earl Grey tea down my scuba boots a minute ago trying to unfreeze my feet.
Oh, my gosh. And the water's that temperature. What's the air temperature?
The air temperature is 28 degrees right now and pleasant little snowstorm, about half a mile of visibility.
Given those conditions, I mean, you don't swim every day, do you?
I can't swim every day in the winter because the outreach part of the swim went so well. You know, I set out to get the word out in the schools and the community groups and every town from Canada all the way down that I had to extend the timeline. And that meant I sort of ran out of money in November as planned. But that means I'm temping this winter and swimming 6 to 12 days a month, fitting it all in, which is just a symptom of being an appallingly average guy.
Well, an appallingly average guy maybe, but doing an extraordinary thing. This will presumably extend the finish line. When do you expect to finally reach the mouth of the river?
It's kind of funny. I was looking at the calendar the other night, exactly a year from when you and I first talked. In the process of which, actually, I was thinking, you said you'd swim a mile or two with me back in June, so I want to say I hope your training's been going well.
Well, it's. Let me put it this way. I'm glad that there's been a delay.
Right. It gives you some chance to really hone your fitness.
Yes, exactly. We have an email message on this subject from a gentleman named Rick Mazzotta in Portland, Oregon, who may not be unknown to you. He writes, Christopher Swain has done exceedingly well to date. The Columbia is a difficult river, more difficult to swim as one progresses downstream. I wish him continued success in 2003 and look forward to watching him reach buoy R6. I assume that's the one right there in the mouth of the river.
That's right. And to get there, I got to swim over the Columbia River Bar, better known as the Graveyard of the Pacific. So I hope Rick comes on out and sees me there. He's a pal of mine from Portland, and he's absolutely right about the river. I mean, in addition to battling ear infections and shoulder soreness and rashes from swimming by pulp mills and cold sores from going by sewage outfalls, I've had days when I've been swimming in storms with 5-foot waves with trees in them, and that gets old when they're hitting you in the head all day long. Honestly, I'll tell you what keeps me going is the people. I haven't found a single person who doesn't tell me that they have an affection for the Columbia River, and I've met thousands of people in Canada and the U.S. so far, and that gives me so much hope, which, to be honest, I didn't have when we talked last. You know, I was hopeful a little bit, because you got to sound hopeful if you're starting something this big. But I'm most encouraged. You know, I spoke with Tom Louie, who's a tribal leader here on the Colville Reservation, which is what's on the right-hand side of the river where I'm swimming right now. And he said back in the 30s, his great-grandfather took him aside when he was a boy. They were standing up by Kettle Falls watching the fishing. And he said, "Grandson, I'm so happy that I have all this to leave you. You've got clean water to drink. You've got the fish to eat. You've got the falls, you've got these mountains here watching over you, and I know I'm going to cross over soon, but I know I can leave you all this and you're going to be okay." And I was talking to him, and he said it's so difficult for him now because, of course, when Grand Coulee went in 1941, that inundated those falls. It shut down the salmon runs, and then the smelting and mining operations in that area basically poisoned the river. I mean, the sediments here are so toxic, they're about to go through a Superfund process for the lake behind Grand Coulee.
Chris, we've got to go, but hey, great good luck, and a mile or two downstream.
Yeah, well, I'll be looking for you, Neil.
I'll be in training in Washington. Alrighty. Swimming it out. I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.